I'm Lister Sinclair with Ideas on CBC Radio and on the internet through www.cbc.ca. On our website, you'll find a series of historical illustrations to accompany tonight's program, as well as the record of an extensive debate that's taking place on the internet today. In the year 1895, the German poet Oskar Panizza wrote a play called The Council of Love, a Celestial Tragedy. The play was about syphilis, a disease Panizza himself suffered from. The opening scene is set in Paradise, in the spring of 1495. A winged messenger arrives in heaven and tells God that dreadful things are happening in the town of Naples. The city is given over to the most ignoble vices, he reports. Bare-breasted women full of lust are running around the streets. The men are burning with animal passion. Vice is breeding vice. God rises from his throne, extending a vengeful fist. I shall exterminate them, he thunders. The cherubim beseech him, don't do that, blessed Lord. You won't have a human race left. So God decides to have the devil concoct an exemplary punishment in the form of syphilis. And so it came to pass that Naples was where the first outbreak of syphilis occurred in 1495. The idea that venereal disease is a retribution for moral transgression has a long history. In 1629, the French poet Jean-Baptiste Lally wrote, the soaring droplets of this cruel sickness fall on those who are hot with love and dirtied with lust. It is a punishment for their misdeeds and their shameful desires. 3 centuries later, the same theme is replayed in our popular discourse about AIDS. The sexual revolution has begun to devour its children, writes U.S. presidential hopeful Patrick Buchanan in 1983. The poor homosexuals, they have declared war upon nature, and now nature is exacting an awful retribution. He continues the theme in 1989 in his syndicated newspaper column. The gays yearly die by the thousands of AIDS, the consequence of their own suicidal self-indulgence. These are lost souls fighting a war against the author of human nature. A war that no man can win. On stage, Oscar Panizza's play is adapted by the British composer Nigel Osborne to reflect the AIDS epidemic. He calls it Hell's Angels. Tonight and tomorrow night, we'll examine the historical parallels between sexually transmitted epidemics of the past and AIDS today. And there are many. The similarities between AIDS and syphilis in particular are striking, whether you look at moral retribution, public health measures, education campaigns, and even perhaps the disease itself. This is Déjà Vu, AIDS in Historical Perspective, presented by science writer Coleman Jones.
When people talk about AIDS today, there's often a sense that it is simply an unprecedented disaster, something never seen before. Dire warnings of the impending die-off in Africa and Asia fill the air. But this modern-day panic ignores the history of epidemics in the past, whose lessons ought to help put AIDS in perspective. Epidemics have changed the course of history. The Black Death of the Middle Ages exterminated a third of the population of Europe in 4 years. The 1918 worldwide influenza pandemic killed more than 20 million people in only a few months. Today, malaria infects 200 million new victims a year, killing millions. In contrast, there have been about 300,000 AIDS deaths in North America total in all the 15 years since the official start of the epidemic in 1981. This epidemic, we're told, is different. Never before has such a lethal disease spread with such rapidity around the world. Yet history says otherwise. The flu epidemic of 1918 infected half the world's population, killing many hundreds of thousands in a matter of weeks. As with AIDS, there was public panic. In San Francisco, the police wore masks and arrested people who didn't. Probably the closest parallel to AIDS is syphilis, which was formerly the most feared of all sexually transmitted diseases. It killed over 2 million people in the United States between the two world wars. Both AIDS and syphilis are transmitted during sex, but can also be transmitted from mother to child, from patient to healthcare worker, and through blood transfusions. Both AIDS and syphilis have long latent periods during which people are free of symptoms, and both can later erupt with awful consequences. As author Gore Vidal says, quote, "It's very difficult for younger people to understand. We are the syphilis generation before penicillin. Every time we had sex, no matter with whom, there was the danger of syphilis and of a hideous death and of never knowing you had it until you suddenly began to have grotesque symptoms." It was syphilis, not AIDS, that first got people thinking about safe sex and condoms. Fear of syphilis was also partly responsible for the Puritan mindset of the Reformation, with its emphasis on monogamy. Today, historians are studying past epidemics of sexually transmitted disease to shed light on the way we're dealing with AIDS.
My name is Jay Castle. I'm a professor at York University. I specialize in medical history. I've written a number of things in the area of STD control, most notably, I suppose, The Secret Plague, which is a full-length study of early efforts at venereal disease control in the first half of the 20th century. Just prior to the First World War, the medical community had made a number of important improvements in its ability to cope with sexually transmitted diseases, most notably syphilis, but also gonorrhea. And as a result of these, and particularly the development of a test that would readily determine whether someone had indeed been exposed to syphilis, to the organism causing syphilis, they were able to establish how many people in the community were likely to be infected, and they discovered that, in fact, the incidence of syphilis was much higher than some, at least, had been inclined to believe. As a result, what we get is a situation in which it looks like there is actually a very serious epidemic of sexually transmitted disease. There is a new plague. This is the great plague of the 20th century. On the other hand, this is a plague that nobody noticed, nobody talked about, nobody was prepared to talk about. And so they spoke of a secret plague. In fact, that was the title of the very first editorial in the Globe and Mail, which ran during the First World War, The Secret Plague. In other words, a disease that was so widespread and yet so completely unknown that most people didn't realize that there was, in fact, something crippling the society as a whole.
My name is Alan Brandt. I'm the Cass Professor of the History of Medicine at Harvard University. I'm the author of a book called No Magic Bullet, which is a study of the history of sexually transmitted diseases in the United States in the 20th century. I think there are very powerful similarities between the response to AIDS in this first 15 years or so and our response to sexually transmitted infections. For one thing, with sexual infections in the past, there was a desire to distinguish between those who were thought to receive their disease as a result of their own willful behavior and a tendency to disregard and deny their needs. And I think that would be characteristic of our response to AIDS. There's also been an attempt in the AIDS epidemic, which is similar to past epidemics, to identify so-called innocent victims. And whenever you suggest in the course of an epidemic that there are innocent victims, what you're really implying is that there are guilty perpetrators of the disease.
As we deal with AIDS, we are once again living through a pattern of squeamishness, denial, stigmatization, and neglect, a pattern repeated through history. Only this time, it's a different disease. Or is it? Is the syndrome AIDS itself new? Jay Castle.
I'm not sure. I don't see any reason to consider catastrophic decline of the functioning of the immune system as new. The sort of markers, the sort of indications that we have for that kind of decline in the functioning of the immune system the proliferation of certain kinds of opportunistic infection. These indications are already evident in the medical literature of earlier decades, and indeed of at least the 19th century.
This is Michigan State University Professor Robert Root Bernstein.
AIDS is not new. I seem to be one of only two or three people who bothered to take the time to go back in the medical literature to actually see whether there are cases that meet the current definitions of AIDS. And you can go back to the very beginnings of almost every single opportunistic disease which we use to define AIDS and find cases that match that definition. For example, Kaposi sarcoma was first diagnosed in 1872. Of the six people that Kaposi actually describes, three of them would have qualified as AIDS patients. Disseminated cytomegalovirus in an adult was first described in 1925. That case would have been an AIDS patient. There are literally hundreds, and I believe probably thousands, of such cases which I've been able to document in the literature, indicating that AIDS is not new. We simply didn't have a category for describing these patients, nor did we realize that somebody who had cytomegalovirus had anything in common with somebody who had Kaposi. So we didn't put them together until about 1980.
Something else we didn't figure out until about 1980 were the sexual inclinations of the people suffering from these various conditions. Most gay men back in the 30s and 40s were in the closet, which made it difficult to tie them together the way we were able to do in the era of gay liberation. Another factor obscuring the recognition of AIDS in the past was the lack of tools to measure the immune system the way we can today. Alan Brandt.
You know, one of the interesting things about AIDS is that it's not that easy to put together as a syndrome unless you have certain kinds of modern medical techniques. And that it's not too hard to imagine that people dying, for example, of different opportunistic infections at a different point in our biomedical history would have been diagnosed as having had different diseases. And if they died relatively young, one might have died of pneumonia, one might have died of something else, and that it wouldn't have been clear that they shared the cause of their disease. So it has occurred to me that one of the characteristics of AIDS is that it took our modern medical technologies in order to be able to identify it as a single problem.
And that single problem, to use Alan Brandt's words, is not new. Because so much of the thinking about AIDS has been done in a climate of emergency about what appears to be this new threat, the careful search for AIDS in the past is only now being done. A few years ago, only a handful of suspected AIDS cases earlier in this century had been uncovered. Now it's clear that AIDS was just as much of a problem back then as it is today. The older syphilis and dermatology texts in particular are full of previously healthy people, mostly young men, dying of all the same complications that kill people with AIDS today. What made these cases worth noting in the old medical textbooks was the failure of the patients to respond to even long courses of treatments that worked for most other people. Instead, they died.
Given what appears in the medical literature in terms of the deaths of certain patients, as it's recorded in American, English, German, French medical literature, it's entirely possible that this phenomenon, however it occurs, has actually been with us for a lot longer than we have hitherto realized. Something has to call it to our attention. This is true of so many other problems in human life. Something calls it to our attention, and then you begin to recognize that it could have been around for a lot longer. Is AIDS new? AIDS, as it is currently defined, consequence of HIV infection, appears to be new. But another thing that I would like to know is, how old is HIV?
If you asked biologist Paul Ewald, or polio pioneer Jonas Salk, or Nobel geneticist Manfred Eigen, or AIDS researcher David Ho, they'd say, based on genetic sequencing, that HIV has been peacefully coexisting in humans for centuries without causing any significant disease. Indeed, George Shearer and Mario Clerici at the U.S. National Institutes of Health have identified many people who have HIV, but don't show any signs of infection-fighting antibodies and aren't the slightest bit sick. These people have been able to keep the virus in check when, for some reason, other people haven't. One theory is that the immune disorder in AIDS, at least some of the time, is due to an old disease that lurks in people who have otherwise harmless HIV. That old disease causes havoc to their immune systems and wakes up the dormant HIV in the process. This old disease, working under the cover of HIV, is the one we've been discussing tonight, syphilis, long called the great masquerader for its ability to mimic the symptoms of many other diseases. Tomorrow night, we'll investigate this provocative idea by going to an STD conference in New Orleans, where syphilis experts gathered to discuss what their disease is doing today in the era of AIDS.
It's been 15 years since a handful of young men in New York and San Francisco began dying of strange pneumonias and cancers. Since then, a private series of tragedies have unfolded into a most public drama, a spectacle that has mixed sex with disease, politics with public health, morals with education. It's a disaster that has engaged all the power of science and medicine, so far with little success. This drama is called AIDS. To some historians, this show looks familiar. 50 years ago, a similar drama was nearing the end of a very long run. It was the tragedy of syphilis, the great pox, transmitted during sex and feared for centuries for the moral dilemmas it created, not to mention the physical ravages it brought. In the days before penicillin, death and disfigurement lay in wait for people with syphilis, who were not much better off than people with AIDS today. Syphilis took an enormous toll, killing 2 million Americans between the two world wars. This is a public health film from the 1940s.
More than 200,000 new infections of syphilis are acquired in this country each year. All are actually or potentially highly infectious.
And the treatments were not inviting. Months of awful injections of arsenic compounds, mercury, or even a dose of malaria. But untreated syphilis caused arthritis, heart disease, blindness, paralysis, and insanity. But some authorities suspected that syphilis could also operate quietly, dispatching its victims in a more indirect and subtle fashion. It seemed that syphilis lowered people's defenses against other infections and malignancies. So instead of the characteristic lesions of late syphilis, sufferers would instead succumb to an old tuberculosis infection that flared up, or a strange pneumonia, or perhaps a rare form of cancer. Joseph Earl Moore, editor of the American Journal of Syphilis, wrote in 1947, "The patient who contracts syphilis is faced with a triple hazard, an unfavorable outcome of his infection, the possibility of a fatal reaction to treatment, and lowered resistance to other diseases." Syphilis was a chameleon. It was called the great imitator, mimicking every disease under the sun. Moore wrote, "In spite of 400 years of study, we still do not know the actual importance of syphilis as a cause of death. To what extent does death directly from syphilis masquerade under other diagnoses? Or to what extent is syphilis an indirect cause of death from other conditions? Is it justifiable to assume that syphilis actually ranks first, instead of its apparent 10th, among killing infections?" These questions were never resolved, because a few years later, along came penicillin, which promised to put an end to syphilis once and for all.
On the basis of present evidence, penicillin appears to have great value in the treatment of syphilis in virtually all stages and manifestations.
Whatever the future may hold for penicillin therapy, we physicians already have in our hands weapons which, with proper medical usage, should enable us to reduce materially the amount of venereal disease in the United States.
the number of newly reported cases plunged and by 1956 reached an all-time low. It looked as though syphilis had finally been conquered. But by the mid-1960s, syphilis was on the increase again, evidence that penicillin, the new wonder drug, had its limits. Sexual freedom was in the air, and the elusive germ of syphilis found a home among hundreds of thousands of unsuspecting victims. In the 1970s, an epidemic of syphilis spread through the gay communities of San Francisco and New York. Within a few years, some of these men began dying of strange pneumonias, rapidly spreading fungus infections, cancers, and reawakened tuberculosis. These conditions looked like the ones seen in late-stage syphilis patients decades before. But nothing like it had been seen by the generation of doctors just out of medical school, and the terror of a mysterious new plague quickly caught fire. One thing was not a mystery. High-tech diagnostic machines were showing that the immune systems of these men were falling apart, unable to contain a whole series of normally harmless infections. And so this peculiar disease came to be known as the acquired immune deficiency syndrome, AIDS. The development of ultra-sensitive techniques revealed what looked like a new virus in these patients, HIV, now called the AIDS virus. Some doctors were not convinced that HIV was behind all of this sickness and death. Almost all AIDS patients were found to have HIV, but not everyone with HIV was getting sick. A debate about the virus began among laboratory scientists. Then, in 1988, a doctor in New York stood up and offered an extraordinary proposition. His name was Stephen Kayatsa.
It would appear from the data that I am generating, and we now have approximately 150 patients, that the difference between an individual who is... the difference between two individuals, both of whom are infected with the so-called AIDS virus, one of whom is ill and the other of whom is doing perfectly fine, turns out to be syphilis. Now, whether that makes syphilis the cause of AIDS or not, I don't know, and quite frankly, I don't care. What I do know is that if there is no syphilis on board, there is no clinical disease on board. No syphilis, no sickness.
Stephen Kayatsa did not live to see his theory either confirmed or refuted. He died in 1991, leaving behind a trail of unanswered questions. Tonight on Ideas, we pick up that trail and continue with our investigation into the history and origin of AIDS. We're in the city of New Orleans. It's August 1995. Researchers from around the world have come to attend a meeting of the International Society for Sexually Transmitted Disease. This is Deja Vu, AIDS in Historical Perspective, presented by science writer Coleman Jones.
It's midnight in New Orleans. The air is hot and muggy as I walk down Bourbon Street, home of some of the greatest jazz clubs in the world. New Orleans has a seamier reputation as well, of a town filled with carnal delights, where many a brothel has opened and closed. It's an appropriate spot for a conference on sexually transmitted diseases, STDs. There are STD researchers from all over the world at this three-day meeting. Here are 10 you'll hear tonight, introducing themselves all at once so you can get an idea of their range of experience and nationalities.
I'm Daniel Musher. I'm the head of infectious diseases at the Baylor College of Medicine and the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Houston, Texas. I'm here at this conference to speak on syphilis and the relationship to HIV infection.
My name is Jadwiga Podwińska. I am associated professor at the Institute of Immunology and Experimental Therapy, Polish Academy of Science in Wrocław. I examine the mechanism of immunological response in syphilis.
I'm István Horváth, doctor of science. I'm working in Hungary, in Budapest, and my main task is with the problem of syphilis.
My name is Bruno Schmidt. I'm working in the Ludwig Boltzmann Institute for dermatovenerological serodiagnosis in Vienna. We are specialists in the STD field, especially for syphilis.
My name is Justin Radoff. I'm associate professor of internal medicine and microbiology at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas.
My name is Dr. Konstantin Borisenko. I am from Moscow. I'm expert of syphilis in Russia.
My name is Robert Rolfs. I'm currently assigned to the Utah State Health Department, where I'm acting director of the Office of Public Health Data.
My name is Nikolai Chaika. I am medical doctor in Ukraine and Russian Federation. During 23 years, more than 23 years, I am at Pasteur Institute. During many years, I pass Western information to Russian physicians and researchers, and vice versa, to pass our information to the West.
My name is Nostromberg Petersen. I'm director of the Staten Serum Institute in Copenhagen, that, among other things, covers all syphilis diagnostic services in Denmark.
My name is Dr. Barbara Romanowski. I'm director of sexually transmitted disease services for the province of Alberta, also a professor of infectious disease at the University of Alberta.
These 10 people are all experts, but they don't all agree with each other. Some of them are very worried about what their disease is doing today. Others are confident it's under control. One debate focuses on whether penicillin really cures syphilis.
A single injection of a long-acting penicillin, a certain number of million of units, cures early syphilis.
It is not cured by penicillin.
I think that one injection is not enough, because we can have complications after 10, 15, 20 years of follow-up. So I think that the duration of penicillium should be longer.
One thing everyone can agree on is that sexually transmitted diseases, including syphilis, are a major health problem worldwide. But STD specialists have been sent to the sidelines, while HIV researchers enjoy the lion's share of funding and public attention. Barbara Romanowski.
The beauty of this conference is that it puts HIV in perspective. The world has gone HIV mad. People seem to be all engrossed by HIV, and they have largely forgotten the other sexually transmitted diseases.
In the United States, STDs strike about 20 million people a year. That's one person every 1.5 seconds, about half of them under the age of 25. The World Health Organization says these infections greatly increase the risk of contracting HIV. It's been known for years that there's an association between STDs and AIDS. An analysis of the first 50 reported AIDS cases revealed that the second most common factor linking them, after the number of male sexual partners, was a history of syphilis. More recent studies have also showed that having a prior history of STDs, particularly syphilis, is one of the most significant predictors for a person turning up with HIV infection. It's even more important than the amount or kind of sex a person has had. In Africa, controlling STDs seems to have a remarkable impact on the transmission of HIV. The sores caused by syphilis probably allow the HIV virus to get into the body more easily. But there may be more to it than that. A number of people I talked to in New Orleans say syphilis, besides facilitating the transmission of HIV, may also trigger otherwise dormant infections and even hasten the development of AIDS itself. There's no question that HIV can lie in the body asleep, so to speak. But when an STD like syphilis comes on board, it may wake up the sleeping HIV, at which point all hell breaks loose. The U.S. multi-center AIDS cohort study, which examined the medical histories of nearly 5,000 gay and bisexual men, found that those who developed AIDS were more likely to have had an STD infection than those who didn't. Despite this clear-cut link with STDs, most scientific work on AIDS centers around unraveling the mysteries of HIV. The impression persists that STDs are only a minor nuisance. One of the reasons STDs have fallen out of the limelight is the mistaken idea that drugs like penicillin have brought them under control. York University historian Jay Castle.
Each new case that came to doctors was rapidly dealt with. Transmission to other people, therefore, was reduced. And as a result, the incidence of sexually transmitted diseases plunged from the later 1940s and remained at remarkably low levels well into the 1960s. Not surprisingly, therefore, from the late 40s onwards, STD education declines almost to the level of zero throughout the American and Canadian world. It didn't seem to be necessary anymore. If somebody got such an infection, they saw the physician dealt with it, case closed. As a result, there was a certain indifference to the hazards, if we can put it that way, of having sex. This indifference to the hazards, if anything, made it much easier to talk in terms of free and open sex with whomever, wherever, whenever you wanted to have sex.
The result was an epidemic of syphilis, especially in the gay community, where it spread like wildfire. Much of it went undiagnosed, because syphilis is frequently missed or mistaken for other diseases. Even the telltale syphilitic sore, known as a chancre, only appears on the genitals or mouth several weeks after exposure. During those weeks, it's possible to infect many others. Barbara Romanofsky.
Unless you're able to treat the patient who presents with the problem and all their sexual partners, then quickly these infections can become out of control.
Strandberg Petersen from Denmark.
In the late 60s, 70s, we had an epidemic, a continuous epidemic of syphilis among homosexual men. And this epidemic was of such a kind that many of the men had had 10 episodes of syphilis. In 1982, the gay community became aware that syphilis was a major problem. Actually, they became aware of this before they became aware of HIV. And they began to write about syphilis in their journals, the gay community journals. And they asked me to make a study in a sauna club in Copenhagen. And this sauna club was a gay sauna, and all the gay people who came there, they were offered a syphilis test. And many of them, actually more than 50% of the people coming there, said, okay, take a syphilis test. And we found many new cases of syphilis.
Which implies that up until that point, a proportion of the gay community had somehow not realized that they had acquired syphilis. Why was that?
Because at least some of the men did not have the chancre on a visible side of the body. If you are doing anal intercourse, then you are at risk of having the chancre in the anus. And actually, that chancres do not cause pain. They are painless. So if you have some other problem with anal problems, like hemorrhoids or other things, you will never notice that you have a chancre there. So at least the members of the homosexual community doing receptive intercourse didn't notice that they actually were infected.
This epidemic, which replayed itself across Europe and North America, was the result of a series of social changes that came to a head in the 1960s. Before then, gay men led quieter lives. There were fewer partners, fewer venues for contact. Not none, but fewer. Then came gay liberation. Once the door to sexual freedom was opened, a new mood settled in. A whole collection of diseases transmitted during sex settled in, too. Antibiotics seemed to deal with most of them. But there were some diseases that a mouthful of antibiotics didn't cure, syphilis in particular. Having spread through the body within hours of infection, the germs of syphilis can persist. Even worse, the infection can be masked by inadequate treatment, which gets rid of the obvious symptoms, but doesn't root out all the germs. This left doctors with only one way to find the disease, blood tests, what's known as syphilis serology. These blood tests don't find the syphilis germ itself, but instead measure various antibodies, disease-fighting substances the body produces in response to the infection. Interpreting the results of these tests is no easy matter. Barbara Romanofsky.
The difficulty with syphilis serology is that there are two groups of tests. There are the screening tests, and there are the very specific confirmatory tests. We get caught because the screening tests, of course, are designed as screening tests and are cheap. And you can do large volumes in a short period of time. And there are individuals who have syphilis who are misdiagnosed because they have only a screening test done, because the sensitivity, depending on the stage of syphilis, certainly is far from being 100%. The sores in early syphilis are painless. The patient may get some antibiotics. The sore goes away. The diagnosis is missed. And in the meantime, transmission has occurred.
In North America, the blood test used to screen for syphilis was developed at the U.S. Venereal Disease Research Laboratory. The test is called the VDRL. It measures antibodies that are not even unique to syphilis. They can also occur in a variety of other diseases and conditions. If the VDRL test shows a reaction, more specific tests are used to confirm the result, tests that measure the antibodies the body makes against the syphilis germ itself. But it's not clear that every case of syphilis is flagged by the VDRL. Polish researcher Jadwiga Podwinska.
This is not specific, and it's one problem. VDR antibodies appeared the beginning of disease. Then VDR antibodies disappear. And somebody may say, oh, the patient is cured, no antibodies. It's not true. The patient should be examined many times, and not only with VDR test. It's not specific and not very good. The better is TPI test.
The TPI is a confirmation test that measures the actual antibodies against the syphilis germ.
Of course, it is difficult. It needs more work. But it is the best test, and I don't know why United States not use it.
Bruno Schmidt from Vienna.
We in Europe can't understand this. When you do only screen with the VDL test, you will miss a lot of these infected patients. So we can't agree with this, but we have not a problem because we are not relying on the VDL alone.
One of the problems with the VDRL is that the antibodies it picks up are the result of the body's response to the early stages of syphilis. This is a kind of immune reaction which people with HIV and AIDS may not be able to make. University of Texas microbiologist Justin Radolph.
Maybe we're putting too much emphasis on serological tests because they're really not very good, particularly in AIDS patients. Anything that depends upon the immune response in an AIDS patient obviously could be suspect. And so that gets to the general question is, how well do these tests perform in general, and do they perform well in an HIV-infected patient population? And that is a very important issue. It was raised in particular with a number of case reports that appeared in the mid to late 1980s. The only thing I can say is that for those of us who have seen many patients with HIV infection, and I'm an infectious disease doctor in addition to a microbiologist, the impression that I have, and I think most individuals have, is that these tests seem to work quite well in the HIV-infected patient population.
Radolph's view is shared by Daniel Musher.
The tests are reliable and reproducible, and they require somebody with a cerebrum at the other end to do some interpreting. But I do assure you it's, in my opinion, not a problem that the disease is not being detected by the available tests. There is some body of opinion, absolutely unsupported, that would make us be afraid that syphilis is out there and not being diagnosed because of the failure of existing tests. There has never been reasonable evidence to support that, even to a slight extent.
Others here in New Orleans aren't so sure. Both the typical symptoms and the antibodies picked up by the tests are the result of an immune response that's usually seen early in the disease. But it's not clear whether these markers can be trusted to appear, especially in people who encounter the disease more than once. This prompts another question.
Do people become immune to syphilis once they've had it? The answer to this question, believe it or not, is still unresolved. In the 1950s, experiments were conducted at Sing Sing Prison in New York, injecting syphilis germs into inmates who'd had syphilis before to see how they would respond to more syphilis. These deliberate re-inoculation experiments showed that prisoners who had suffered from a long-term syphilis infection usually showed no new reaction to more germs. They had neither typical symptoms nor a characteristic rise in VDRL antibodies. Most researchers concluded that these men were therefore immune to syphilis. But there's another possibility, that the opposite was true, namely that they had lost their ability to control the infection. Even though it looked like the infection was thwarted, the evidence suggests the syphilis germs may still have invaded their tissues and organs. Earlier experiments in the 1940s showed that re-inoculating syphilitic rabbits with more syphilis resulted in the germs spreading again throughout the body, even in animals who showed no typical outward response. They call this type of infection symptomless syphilis. Many experts thought this kind of silent infection could easily occur in humans as well, and people could both acquire and pass on the disease without ever knowing it. Several hundred thousand cases of syphilis are known to have gone untreated among gay men immediately prior to the current AIDS epidemic. Yet the typical symptoms of late-stage syphilis have essentially disappeared in this population. Where did all this syphilis go? The majority of syphilis that's diagnosed today is among people without HIV. The rare time an active case of early syphilis does show up in someone with HIV, it behaves much like it does in anyone else, no more severe or harder to treat than in people without HIV. This is very peculiar. Infections that are harmless in healthy people can prove lethal in people who have damaged immune systems. Yet syphilis, which has killed many millions of people over history, never seems to kill anyone who has AIDS.
The Centers for Disease Control said there were 325,000 cases of untreated and undiagnosed syphilis in the United States in 1981. I'm having a tough time understanding why, with all that untreated syphilis around, knowing what we know about the course of untreated syphilis, why it's not more of a problem in AIDS. You know, I mean, where are the AIDS patients dying of untreated syphilis? Right. I mean, where are they? Is there one that you know of?
Justin Radolf.
I think part of the answer to your question, I mean, first of all, nobody knows exactly what the answer to your question is. And there are, there has been a group of investigators, and I don't know if investigator is the right word because I think they're a little bit on the fringe, who believe that syphilis is very widespread in the AIDS community. Serological tests that we normally use are not very accurate. And there was a time, not so much now, but maybe about 5 or 10 years ago, when AIDS was first becoming recognized, that they were treating very liberal in treatment, giving syphilis treatment to AIDS patients, and even claiming that it had a significant impact on their clinical course.
One of these fringe investigators was a doctor in New York. Most of his patients were gay men. His name was Stephen Kayatza.
I was seeing the full spectrum of sexually transmitted diseases, gonorrhea, herpes, chlamydia, HIV, amoebiasis, you name it. But I wasn't seeing syphilis. Maybe I would see 2 cases a year. I thought that odd. The next thing that happened is that in 1985, I had 3 patients in a row, all of whom had full-blown AIDS, who came up with positive tests for syphilis, just coincidentally and by accident. I treated those patients for their syphilis, but in a very standard way. And to my amazement, I noticed that while I was treating their syphilis, their AIDS symptoms were getting better. Now, the mistake I made was that I followed standard protocol and I stopped treating their syphilis at what would be called a traditional and appropriate time, and then their AIDS got worse and they died. But that made me realize that 2 things were going on. One, the tests we use to diagnose syphilis simply don't work. And 2, syphilis was playing a very significant role in whatever AIDS really turns out to be. I then took about 8 months off, took a sabbatical, went to Germany, did some research with two Germans who independently had reached the same conclusion, and then came back to the United States in January of 87 and began taking all of my AIDS patients and treating them for syphilis.
Stephen Kayatsa used a long course of slow-release penicillin and another antibiotic called doxycycline. He did this regardless of whether the patients showed syphilis antibodies, which normally remain for several decades in people who've had the symptoms of syphilis in the past. But the absence of these antibodies doesn't necessarily mean that a person with HIV has never had syphilis before. Several medical centers have reported an unusually quick disappearance of these antibodies among people with HIV, while antibodies against other infections remain. Only the syphilis antibodies fall away. What was even more unusual is that some of the patients being treated as if they had syphilis regained their antibodies in the syphilis tests. And some of Kayatsa's patients did seem to be getting better. In other words, it looked like treating them aggressively for syphilis, whether they seemed to have it or not, helped their AIDS. This intrigued a man in Toronto, John Sides.
People weren't doing very well here, and so we thought it might be worth bringing him up and examining his evidence. He did provide seemingly sincere case reports to me of reversion back to positive in syphilis tests, stability of T cells, and some other intimations that there was some impact here, and I circulated that to physicians, and a number of people elected to take his treatment, and their doctors kindly obliged them.
But the promise failed. It soon became clear that Kayatsa's method of treating AIDS wasn't going to do the trick. Stephen Kayatsa himself died from what were said to be AIDS-related complications. For most people, this put an end to the syphilis-AIDS theory. After all, if penicillin cures syphilis, why didn't it work for AIDS? As it turns out, it's not clear whether the kind of penicillin used in North America really does cure syphilis, which would mean eliminating all the syphilis germs, called treponemes. Treponemes are a part of a family of spiral-shaped bacteria known as spirochetes, another of which causes Lyme disease. A characteristic feature of all these germs is their ability to burrow into the body's cells and tissues and hide away out of the reach of antibiotics. One of the world's experts on spirochetes is Bruno Schmidt from Vienna.
In patients with long infections, with chronic infections, these spirochetes can get to places where no antibiotics can reach them. In syphilis, we don't have a proof, this kind of thing. In the last years, no one had looked for this. But I know it from Lyme disease, that especially chronic infections, you can find the spirochetes despite adequate treatment.
The question of how much penicillin cures syphilis has been under debate ever since the drug was first used in the 1940s. North American doctors say that one shot of slow-release penicillin is enough to cure most cases of early syphilis. Doctors on the other side of the Atlantic, especially in Eastern Europe, treat patients with daily injections of much higher doses of penicillin over a period of several weeks, often months, or even years. They're afraid that antibiotics, if not given in sufficient amounts, eliminate the outward symptoms of syphilis without curing the underlying infection. They see the clinical symptoms, the rashes and sores, as only the tip of the syphilis iceberg. István Horváth from Hungary.
Very often happened that the patient had antibiotics and all the clinical manifestation disappeared. And at the beginning, the physician believed that they were cured. Now we know that it is not true. The treponemes can survive. And when the immunological situation in the body change, maybe the treponemes appear again, and maybe they can produce a late syphilitic phenomenon in the patient, or may be not typical syphilis, Villepierre, but these treponemes can destroy partly, or I can say mainly, the immune system.
In other words, without enough penicillin, the germ of syphilis, Treponema pallidum, or T. pallidum for short, can damage the immune system, making the body vulnerable to otherwise harmless infections and cancers. I put this idea to some American experts. First, Justin Radolf.
There's been that speculation. Is syphilis immunosuppressive, or does T. pallidum have an immunosuppressive effect on the immune system? And in fact, in the 70s in particular, there was a lot of literature supporting that. And there's also been a literature related to that, that during the secondary stage in particular, there's a profound immunosuppressive effect. I think currently that's not really the thinking. A lot of those studies need to be redone. But I really do not believe that T. pallidum causes a global suppression of the immune system that then leaves one susceptible to malignancy or other infectious diseases and things along that line. Now, I don't think there's any evidence for that right now.
Robert Rolfs from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
I haven't seen any evidence that it's true. I think that there are people who've looked pretty carefully at the mechanism by which HIV causes AIDS, and while all the answers aren't in, I don't think they found evidence that T. pallidum had a role in it. And I think that there have been studies that, you know, people might have found that or would have found that if it were. So I don't believe that to be true. I'm not sure we understand everything about AIDS either, so I can't rule it out. But I don't believe it to be true.
But in Eastern Europe, syphilis researchers have found that even one infection with Treponema pallidum, that's the syphilis germ, interferes with cells of the immune system. It's the same cell-mediated immune response that eventually fails in people with AIDS. People with AIDS have very reduced numbers of blood cells known as T cells. This deficiency is usually blamed on the effects of HIV, but there may be other causes. Jadwiga Podwinska from Poland.
As we found in syphilis, the level of these cells in patient was also very low. We know that these people were not infected with HIV because we were examined for it. They had only syphilis.
Professor Podwinska is an immunologist, and her 35 years of experience working on syphilis has given her a unique insight into how this disease works. It seems that once the infection has set in, the cells of the immune system switch off many of their responses against it. Over time, the cells essentially lose their memory of how to fight the disease, so the body no longer resists new infections of syphilis. These reinfections may have grave consequences, turning off still more parts of the immune system. Syphilitic guinea pigs given more syphilis show no outward symptoms or VDRL antibodies, but this symptomless re-exposure produces pronounced changes in their immune function. Could this symptomless form of infection do the same thing in people, ruining their immune systems? Might this account for the high death rates among syphilitics historically, due to everything from pneumonia and tuberculosis to cancer? These are the kinds of questions being asked by Toronto's John Sides. He's convinced that the outward symptoms of syphilis are only one aspect of its potential for harm.
The history of this disease suggests that it kills by immune suppression. So that means that there's a whole spectrum of syphilis which is not the classical signs and symptoms which doctors are trained to diagnose. There is a symptomless form of the disease, and the animal models also support this.
Ever since he brought Stephen Kayatza to talk to a group of people in Toronto back in 1988, which is when I first met him, John Sides has grown more and more convinced that syphilis is a major cofactor in HIV infection and the development of AIDS. After studying the old syphilis literature, he began writing letters to medical journals, to officials at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, Health and Welfare Canada, and scientists at universities all over the world. Then, in 1992, a letter came from Anton Luger, one of Austria's leading syphilis experts. "I agree with your hypothesis," Professor Luger wrote. Hungary's István Horváth also wrote from his lab in Budapest, saying, "Your idea is excellent. I think only a few people can recognize the reality in the field of AIDS." John Sides has since traveled to dozens of AIDS and STD conferences, where he has published his ideas for the experts to look at. Here in New Orleans, István Horváth and John Sides are taking in the nightlife. There's nothing quite like this club in Budapest. As for Sides, traveling the STD circuit is a curious sideline for a man who worked as a plumbing contractor for 20 years and who now owns Glad Day Bookshop in Toronto.
I don't think I really succeeded in getting specialists in infectious diseases interested in hearing this until 92 or 93. Eventually, I was able to get myself invited to various academic institutes in Europe, like the Allgemeines Krankenhaus and the Academic Medical Center in Amsterdam, the Semmelweis University in Budapest. I've had some very fine correspondence from them, suggesting that I have some very important ideas that will have to be investigated before we will resolve AIDS. In European medical centers, there seems to be some willingness to consider syphilis as a cofactor for susceptibility to HIV and the progression of the syndrome towards full-blown AIDS.
And judging from my own discussions in New Orleans, it looks like John Sides has a lot of support. This is Hungary's top syphilis expert, István Horváth.
It is well known nowadays that the treponemes are producing a so-called cellular depletion in the body. It means that the immune cells are not so strong to protect the body against infection. Nowadays, people talk about AIDS. And if the syphilis-causing microbe, the treponema pallidum, is in the body, maybe it helps the infection with the HIV virus.
Poland's authority on syphilis is Jadwiga Pabinska.
Those people who now are infected with HIV first had syphilis. Maybe it was cured, but not completely. And maybe the suppressed cell-mediated immune response was what allowed HIV to better develop in people.
In Moscow, Dr. Konstantin Borisenko is in charge of Russia's syphilis program.
Syphilis is very high suppressive influence on immune system, and even if a patient has no signs of this disease, it helps to get many other infectious diseases. It helps for HIV infection, it helps to get viral diseases and to develop in a few years some typical immunological disturbances. I think that not only in the United States, but in many countries, including Russia, we didn't always know all damages that syphilis brings. 5 years ago in Russia, we examined patients who had syphilis 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago. It was very difficult to find them because they tried to forget about their problems. But what we revealed, that patients with syphilis in past, after many years, they have statistically more often cardiovascular problems, immunological problems, mental problems, and especially cancer problems. So syphilis is a real disease that I think did not disappear with this simple treatment. It is not examined properly even now.
Here at the conference, the young North American researchers keep their distance from the generally older Eastern European experts. The Americans reject the idea that syphilis could be playing a major role in AIDS. Ukrainian researcher Nikolai Chaika.
I think that maybe they are so brave in their definitions because they have small clinical experience. You know, I am 50 years old, more than 50, so I'm like from previous generation, so I'm quite skeptical about modern young physicians. After several mistakes, they will be more cautious and more reasonable in their diagnosis and in their criteria for diagnosis. Young physicians, they are not experienced enough to realize the complex nature of the disease. So they follow simple definitions.
The Americans may follow simple definitions, but they also know that syphilis sometimes can hide from the immune system. John Sides.
They have published some very provocative papers on how syphilis interacts with the immune system. And they somehow open this can of worms that there's a big problem with syphilis and conduct a whole bunch of experiments that show that you can get symptomless syphilis from re-exposure, and then they seem to stop. They don't go any further, and here they are suggesting that there's a problem with syphilis in the sense that they call it the stealth pathogen. They open up their presentations with a picture of the stealth bomber and then underneath a picture of the stealth pathogen, which is the Treponema pallidum, the corkscrew organism that causes syphilis.
It's Justin Radolf who has the stealth bomber slide, but he's not worried that there's a hidden epidemic.
The only thing I can say is that the consensus at the present time amongst investigators in the field, people who I think have credibility, is that there is simply not this reservoir of untreated disease that is causing tremendous morbidity in the AIDS patient population. There is disease in the AIDS patient population. It does exist, and it does need to be found. So I want to make sure it's very clear. I'm not by any stretch of the imagination stating that I do not believe that syphilis and other latent STDs are unimportant. However, I believe that our ability to identify them, either using the serological tests or clinical criteria, are quite good. They're not necessarily perfect, but they're good enough that we do not have to begin to go on fishing expeditions or start to treat everyone, all the people come into our clinics, things along that line.
Bruno Schmidt from Vienna thinks hunting down the effects of chronic syphilis is worthwhile.
I'm convinced that we have to do this research. Up to now, it was not possible, but we have now in the last years got new tools. We can check these chronic infections, and I think we have to do it.
Russia's Konstantin Borisenko also wants these questions addressed.
I suspect that syphilis and HIV infection, they're much more closer than we used to think. I believe that this question must be solved.
If many people with AIDS really do have undiagnosed chronic syphilis, it's going to be hard to prove, at least by the commonly used techniques. Currently, the only way to assess what syphilis is doing is by using blood tests that measure antibodies. But these indirect tests may not be reliable in people with immune problems. But other avenues could be pursued. For example, if chronic syphilis interferes with the way immune cells react, what might those cells do if examined outside the body? With other infections, like tuberculosis and Lyme disease, it's possible to put a person's cells in the test tube, stimulate them with the germ in question, and produce a different response than was seen in the body. Doing this kind of syphilis research in a world obsessed with HIV is nearly impossible. Research money is in short supply. As Dr. Sandra Larson, a top syphilis expert at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, told me, "We have not looked at some of the concerns that you have expressed because we just haven't had the funding, nor the time, nor the means for doing it. We have a limited budget and a limited number of people, and we're shrinking daily." In Canada, there is no formal ongoing syphilis research. Furthermore, basic science grants for AIDS research, given out by the government and private fundraisers like the Canadian Foundation for AIDS Research, CANFAR, are exclusively directed towards HIV-related research. John Sides.
We had one interesting research proposal turned down by CANFAR where we wanted to stimulate the cells of men with HIV infection and measure their response. This has been done with HIV, tuberculosis, and it should be done with syphilis. It's been done with dozens of diseases. It's not particularly expensive. It's much more expensive than a syphilis screening test, which is a dollar or two. But I think it needs to be done to confirm whether the antibody tests are indeed picking up syphilis in this population.
Daniel Musher, who believes there's no hidden syphilis.
Having stated as firmly as I did what I told you, when I say there's no evidence, that was my opinion, there's no evidence. Now, I would say that study is always indicated to see if the evidence changes.
Justin Radolf.
There's only a small group of people doing syphilis research. And of those, only a subset are really doing what I would consider to be first-class immunological study. It's going to be, just for that reason, for mere numbers reasons, it's going to be a while before we have the answers. And that's actually, it's too bad, because one would worry that if, along the lines of your earlier questioning, that if some of my views are not correct, if it turns out to be valid that because of immunosuppression or other factors that syphilis is sneaking through the cracks in a significant patient population, then we're not finding these people. We don't have the tests available to do that, and that's, as a physician who's concerned about the public health, I mean, that's a serious situation.
In the meantime, the world's leading syphilis heretic, John Sides, continues to ask awkward questions.
It's fun to bring these ideas to the scientific community and see if they can refute them. So far, I don't think they can refute them. And the reason I feel confident is that I have friends who have been very kind to me, like Noel Rose at Johns Hopkins and Anton Luger at the Ludwig Boltzmann Institute in Vienna, who have said that I have made what they consider to be good scientific points. I also persist in this area of research because the current wisdom, after I don't know how many billions of direct applied research to the virus, isn't working. And my answer to that is HIV is only part of the puzzle, and the AIDS risks really are what cause AIDS, that is, other unidentified cofactors are as important as the virus, let's put it that way. Whereas we've spent no money on syphilis, even though all of the animal and human, deliberate human inoculation experimentation, indicates clearly that syphilis, after 2 to 3 to 4 to 6 months, shuts down the immune system so that the disease redisseminates in the body quietly. That evidence has been published for the last 80 years, ever since 1912, when Karl Landsteiner started doing it in primates in Java. When you have such an organism, and it looks like it can kill by immune suppression, then I think you have to reinvestigate what it's doing now when we're looking for what's going on in this epidemic.
Deja Vu, AIDS in Historical Perspective, was prepared for ideas by science writer Coleman Jones. We've posted extensive background information about this series, including historical illustrations and scientific references, on the Internet. You'll find us on the World Wide Web through www.cbc.ca. For a printed transcript of these two ideas programs, which costs $13, call toll-free 1-800-363-1530. Or write to us at Ideas, Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Ideas Tonight was produced by Max Allen, with technical operations by Lorne Tuck. I'm Lester Sinclair.
I'm beginning to see what you're up against. The same old mistakes over and over again. What are we going to do to put young men wise?
I can show you one of the answers to that question if you have a little time to spare.
I'm right with you, Doctor. Today they're running a new film for a group of young men to show them how to protect themselves from contracting venereal diseases.
Those are the facts about syphilis and its dangers.